This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good. How about yourself?
Doing pretty good. Our thoughts go out to the people in the Midwest who are experiencing the polar vortex. I think it's, minus 30 degrees outside. I saw a little news clip in Chicago. Some of the railroads have to be set on fire. The railways have to be set on fire. Otherwise, they're too cold to turn. So,
yeah, there you go. How much more evidence do we need of global warming?
All right. Now we're going to get emails. Now we're going to get emails.
Yeah, that's all. That's fine. Bring it on.
I love it.
All right. What else we
all
got
right,
going?
Well, today we are going to talk about a little bit about female ambition and the psychology of such. So we're going to start off right away without any further ado. Dr. Lyle, this is in context with talking about playing guitar and doing sports.
Mm-hmm.
And a listener writes, Dr. Lyle, if things like sports and playing guitar and doing art are sexual displays that help men attract mates, but nothing will attract a man to a woman if she doesn't first cut the mustard on appearance, what motivates women to be involved in the more aggressive end of sports and music? With respect to music, I particularly mean more aggressive or rock-type music as opposed to acoustic stuff. This listener's hypothesis is it the idea of if I fit in or copy the boys, they'll like me? Or are these women just more testosteronized, even if they don't look like it? The financial reward potential might be a factor, but maybe this goes beyond any hope of finances.
Very good question. I can't speak directly to an answer, but if we back the camera up, we're going to look at performance arts as fitness indicators and arts in general are fitness indicators. And so it's going to be true that both males and females are going to, use these avenues in order to display their fitness. And so we would expect, in general, we're going to expect that males are going to be more interested in displaying essentially aggression, protection, capabilities, et cetera. So we're going to look at sports, and females or women, we're going to see more display of their sexual attractiveness directly. So we're going to see looking at singing would be a way to, for example, display high feminized voices, and obviously singing and acting are ways to display your just sheer physical attractiveness. And certainly modeling. There's those sorts of things. Interestingly enough, that women are interested in displaying other artistic capabilities like interior design, fashion design, fashion design is getting involved in interest in clothing to, i.e., make one's body more sexually attractive, et cetera. So you can see that female fitness indicators are designed for things that make a lot of sense to us in terms of displaying essentially estrogen cues, and male fitness indicators are very much around displaying testosterone related cues. So that's not any big surprise. The fact that there's a small degree of overlap between these bell curves shouldn't shock us. And so the I think when this person hypothesized that we're probably seeing more testosteronized females, you know, if you've got some female with a guitar in her hand that's banging out, you know, hard rock, that is very likely to be a highly testosteronized female. And she may not look like it physically, but you can't tell the distribution of testosterone or estrogen in anybody just by looking at their physical form. You know, you have to understand that the brain could have been testosteronized in, you know, and yet the body is evidencing a high degree of estrogen cues. So the cues are not distributed homogeneously throughout the phenotype. So so that obviously is a big deal. And you're also going to see that, remember that the propensity to display cues and even certain types of cues, it's not a let me see what I'm trying to get said here. The ambition that is involved in producing fitness indicators and competing to try to climb dominance hierarchies in order to get there, the fact that you're also looking to possibly, you might carry, for example, aggressive physical protection and domination cues as a female and display those, but really in your gene pool, those are going to be more successful when they wind up sitting inside your son or your brother. So the fact that you happen to have those cues isn't necessarily in any way related to a female strange-looking strategy. It just so happens that that's sitting big and loud inside that gene pool, and that individual who happens to have a female and would otherwise have these things muted and directed towards other fitness indicators that are more associated with female displays – It is essentially loud enough and broad and wide enough in that gene pool, it's leaking over into what is would conventionally be testosterone displays. So I think that that's what it is. The evidence for testosteronization and this kind of these kind of displays comes from research showing that women that are more testosteronized are far more likely to be physically aggressive, much more likely to be involved in sports, et cetera, than women that have less testosterone. So the testosterone is a key indicator there, and therefore it's no surprise that if that quantity goes up, whether it's in a male or a female, we're going to start seeing what we would traditionally view as male-oriented behavior.
Fascinating. Now, the next question actually has to do with ambition as this keeps going. And so the listener comments, Dr. Lyle, the family size seems to drop as women's education improves. What do you think is the reason behind this? Have the possibilities of education and a career, perhaps even pressure to pursue a career, affected the average woman's happiness for the better or for the worse?
Well, let me think about this. There's some interesting ideas that this person is knocking on. Let's first of all look at family size and women's education. So certainly we live in a world where if you have the brains and if you have the conscientiousness, then what's going to happen is that it makes sense to invest in an education. An education is effectively improving improving your mental capital. It's making you more capable of solving problems that other people can't solve. Now, it may just mean that we're headed for some government guild, that there's a gatekeeper somewhere and that you actually don't learn anything useful, but you just have a stripe on your head that says that you're worth $100,000 a year and other people aren't, okay? But let's ignore that inefficiency in the marketplace, and let's just assume that more education in principle means more specialized knowledge, ability to solve problems, be more valuable, and therefore make more money. therefore, it would make sense for people, men and women, to look at their chops, look at what the marketplace demands, look at what the cost-benefit analysis is of investing in your education, estimate your lifespan and your useful time that you would spend using that education, and multiply that by the amount of money, divide it by the amount of effort that it's going to take to get this thing, and come up with a decision about whether or not we're going to invest in our education. So let's suppose that, first of all, we have to understand that increased women education is not happening uniformly. It's happening selectively among women that are more intelligent and more conscientious. So because there is more use for higher levels of education as you get to be a more sophisticated industrialized society, then it's going to turn out that it's more worth it to make that investment. So that's happening. Now, when you do that and you start investing in that education, you're reducing the amount of time that it makes sense to be having children. You can't be in med school and be a mom. Now, can you? Yeah, you can, but good luck to you. Now, I hope you're already independently wealthy so you can have a nanny. I mean, this is going to be exceedingly difficult to do. And so the same thing is true if you're in an MBA program, PhD program, physical therapy program, et cetera, et cetera. So the same high conscientiousness that's going to be involved in getting an education and the same intelligence that's involved in getting an education is also going to be involved in systematically and intelligently using birth control. So what's going to happen is we're going to narrow the window of how many years you have that are going to be fertile, where you're going to be on the child market. And so we're going to cut it down by a whole lot. So it's very likely that, from 18 years old to 30, a young woman is pursuing her education and investing in it, whereas some other woman who's not pursuing that education, there's no particular reason to stop her from starting to have children when she's 22. So the window can be twice as long for somebody who's not pursuing higher education. So that we have to factor that in. Now we go to another part of this person's question. So even if we didn't have intelligence and conscientiousness, if we didn't have personality variables in the game, we would already see family size dropping as education would increase just because of the window involved, the time and energy involved in having children, making it essentially prohibitively expensive time and energy wise for somebody who's pursuing higher education. Now we're going to look at the other things that could be involved. It's going to turn out that what would be the impact on women's happiness with respect to this state of affairs. We can look at this problem. It would be very hard to look at it theoretically. So there would be no evolutionary lens where we could say, gee, would you be happier as long as you were reasonably safe and reasonably comfortable and reasonably secure financially? Is there any reason why you wouldn't want to have six children and start having those children at 18 or 19? After all, you're a biological reproduction machine. Why wouldn't that be possibly a superior path towards greater happiness than someone who works on her career, gets herself an MBA, JD from Duke, and then starts, hits the market at 29 years old and makes a lot more money and now has a narrower mating window and then squeezes in a couple of kids, by her 40th birthday. So, who's happier? It turns out that the lady from Duke is happier. It turns out that in general, if we run a correlation coefficient on these life choices, as best we can tell, the more money people have, the happier they are. And specifically, it isn't actually the greater the net worth, it's actually the income. Now, there'd be a variety of reasons for this that I don't think have necessarily been very well parsed out, not by the research that I've seen. So the greater your income, what's happening is that the environment is signaling to you that you're valuable to the coalition. So if you're a trust fund baby and somebody just hands you a $5 million net worth, that we wouldn't expect that to create the level of happiness that earning $100,000 a year would achieve. The reason we, if you're in economic deprivation, you may not be able to see that. That's because money doesn't buy happiness. What money does is it subtracts and potentially eliminates unnecessary misery. So when people are in deprivation, they believe that if they hit the lottery, this is going to like really make their lives a lot better. What it will do is it'll eliminate misery caused by deprivation, but it's not going to actually put happiness in the system. It's a different phenomenon. And so the happiness is going to be caused by earning esteem in the right way from the people that matter. So that means essentially earning the respect and regard of people that you're doing worthwhile work for, somehow connected to market processes, tells the organism that they are fundamentally secure and valuable. And you don't get that by being a trust fund kid, and you don't get that by winning the lottery. So or getting lucky on an investment, or Uncle Louis, you know, gave you some money or whatever. It doesn't do the same thing. And so this is why we're going to see higher incomes associated with higher happiness, partly as a result of they're getting stronger signals of esteem from the marketplace. In addition, the higher income female is in a much greater position of power across a number of life domains. So they're going to have much less dependence on mates. So if it turns out that a mating situation goes sour, which they generally will, it's going to turn out that that under those conditions, they're not going to be economically dependent and have to stick in a situation that they don't want to be in. They're going to be less dependent upon the personality and whims of their bosses or the situation with a company or anything else under the sun. They're not having to work on a factory floor in the company town, putting in popsicle sticks, you know what I mean, for $10 an hour. And then when it turns out that the factory closes, they're in trouble. Okay. No, they've got options. They're fine. Their employer has competitors for their valuable abilities, and therefore they're not pinned into anything. They're also less dependent upon their family. So when their father or their mother or Uncle Louie or somebody tells them they need to stay in a marriage, or they need to do this, or they need to do that, or you better come over for dinner every Sunday night, and you better not, you know, you better not vote for the people on the other end of the political spectrum that we don't believe in. Otherwise, you know, I mean, you're going to lose the family support. Well, guess what? If I make my own money and I'm financially independent and I'm getting cues from the marketplace of my independent, then I can display who it is that I am and be who it is that I want to be without nearly the fear of family censure and rejection from coalition where we have conflicts of interest. And so as a result of many of these factors, and probably ones I'm not thinking of, we would expect increased income to be correlated with happiness. Therefore, we would expect with women with higher educations that it wouldn't be long before the world gets smart enough to figure out that it's worth pursuing more abilities in the marketplace. And so as a result, women start to do this. They start to reduce their breeding windows. And as a result, we're going to wind up with less kids and more happiness. And that's what we find. And so, like I said, we wouldn't necessarily have, on prima facie evolutionary grounds, expected this. We might have said, well, gee, maybe this is much ado about nothing, and the inherent joys of raising children and watching these little things grow would be so rewarding and feel so inherently productive that the lady with six kids is happier than the lady with zero, one, or two. It turns out to be that is not the case. So for the reasons I've outlined, and probably ones that I, not to mention, for example, that in general, people with higher intelligence have a wider range of interests. And it turns out that we live in a world now that you have the ability to actually indulge those interests. So if you have the means and the freedom from the constraints that we were just talking about, you can travel the world, you can read books, you can look at videos, and effectively you can spend your time in many ways that will activate happiness mechanisms inside your head that are independent of the joys and tribulations of motherhood. And so as a result, these and other factors, like I said, that I'm not considering, would result in, you know, probably conscious as well as unconscious choice mechanisms, CBs being run in the heads of young women, saying, you know what, I'm putting this thing off. I'm going to put off having kids. I'm going to reduce this. I'm only going to have it under idealized circumstances. In other words, they start beating their genes. And that's why these are some of the reasons why you're going to see women's education and family size, you know, negatively correlated.
That's really fascinating. I was typing up a question, follow-up question about the, you know, having kids who value you versus having a marketplace that values you, and you answered it right at the very end of the explanation. So it's really curious that do you think that not having kids results in a little less happiness at the end of life?
You know, that's a good question. Now, and it, once again, this one would have to be solved empirically because there would be no theoretical way to do it. It turns out that couples don't have children are at least as happy as couples that have children, interestingly enough. Now, I don't know when they're taking that data, and there's many factors. This doesn't mean that in principle children are a happiness zero. In other words, your particular child and your particular life, it could be immensely positive, and the CB could have been huge in the positive direction for you. God knows it was for my parents. All protestations to the contrary. So the point is that, however, what we see is, you know, when we actually look at it empirically, we see that it's at least a fair shake for not having kids. Now, what we're going to find within this data is we're going to find enormous individual variation. So I know that there are women who are really, really tortured by the fact that they did not have children. And it's just flat out hard on them. And it's just the way it is. They've got a maternal chip in there, and the way circumstances played out in their life, it just turned out that wasn't possible. And you know, they'd really feel a haunting emptiness. And that's, you know, it doesn't surprise me that such a thing exists at all. I find that, by the way, much less, way more rarely expressed in males. Although I have seen it, okay? But I would say that I've seen it expressed in females probably 10 to 1 more than males, which is kind of interesting and indicative of essentially the natural difference between men and women in terms of the sort of emotional connection and investment that goes on with child rearing. So that's what it looks like, and that's what I know. And so if you can't have kids and you really wanted them, you know, it's a tough situation. You can obviously mimic it a little bit in a number of ways, that's one of the reasons, one of several reasons why we have pets, is that it's very much a parental type of a process and a fascination with personality and a joy of creating happiness in another nervous system that's dependent. This is very much akin to what's happening in parent-child process until teenagers,
wow.
Until they become teenagers.
So, Dr. Lyle,
yeah.
With regards to the couple, the study that you, or the data that you cited about couples being just about as happy with kids versus
mm-hmm.
without kids.
Yeah.
And I know there's limitations to that, as you stated, but do you consider that a paradox in that, you know, there's the biological purpose of life is survival and reproduction, but and the moods of happiness are designed to tell us that we're on that right path, but we can artificially
mm-hmm.
create these moods of happiness without actually, you know, reproducing.
Yeah, I think it seems a little bit paradoxical that when we think about it this way. That think about the way the nervous system is engineered is it's engineered to try to get you to do things that will cause the reproduction of DNA. Now, it's going to turn out that what that means is attraction, lust, romance, sex. That's what causes the DNA to be reproduced. Now, once the DNA is reproduced, you're stuck, okay? The little thing is squalling. It's vulnerable as hell. Okay, now we're going to spend a tremendous amount of time and anxiety over this enormous biological investment. This little thing is going to signal every little perturbation of discomfort that it's going to have. It's going to be screaming for attention and resources, okay, and protection, et cetera. So as a result, now suddenly, guess what our focus is now not on? It's not on romance, lust, sex, et cetera. Romance, forget about it. It's on making sure that this little thing manages to survive, okay? And then it becomes on attempting to engineer socially and with instruction this thing's rise in the socio-cultural dominance hierarchy so that it can maximize its fitness displays and therefore have its own romance and sex process that's optimal with the best possible specimen on the other side of the table that we're trying to chisel 10% extra gene quality out of so that the grandchildren will then be fancy. Okay, so suddenly the game just went away from your own personal consumption of lust, romance, sex, adventure, and it just went into now we're incredibly fascinated with this process. Now, what did evolution do? Evolution essentially put a huge lure out there and a lot of positive affect around the romance, lust, sex, etc. That's what it did, okay? What it then did was it put a lot of anxiety, nervousness, you know, tension, irritability, you know, pushing and shoving, worry, put all kinds of things associated with the protection of this asset once you've got it. Interesting, okay? So evolution engineered the human psychology in such a way that turns out to be optimal for the reproduction of the DNA, but by no means, if by following that script, you actually optimize the life experience of the individual. So that's the resolution of the paradox, is that evolution was never designed to optimize your happiness. It was designed to goad you into doing its bidding, and it was going to throw you little bits of happiness and pleasure along the way to get you to do it. And after that, it was going to throw you a lot of anxiety and tension and sweat. Okay? And so that's how it's done. And that's why we call this podcast Beat Your Genes, is because we're absolutely out to try to outthink that system and to try to actually optimize your personal life experience rather than optimize your DNA success.
Yeah, and speaking of you know, these genes trying to get you to do things, I'm going back to what you said earlier about women's education and that more intelligent, more conscientious people will tend to be getting more educated. And I can just hear and, you know, see in my you know, just the kind of fantasy of news headlines and, you know, population behavior of people saying, oh, well, now that Dr. Lyle says more intelligent, more conscientious people go to college, now people are going to go to college in order to display more intelligence, conscientiousness. So the question is, what is it with our drive to deceive and this deception? You know,
Keep talking. I'm not quite not quite there with you yet. Keep trying. Ask me again.
Okay.
Try to figure out what you're trying to ask.
Yeah, what I'm trying to ask is people will make a false correlation that, if more intelligent and conscientious people go to college, therefore, if I go to college, I will be more intelligent and conscientious. And so I guess that's the big question is, my suspicion is that it's more of a display as, oh, I'm going to go to college in order for people to believe that I'm more intelligent and conscientious since, you know, someone tells me that's the case.
Right. Yeah, so people are going to sometimes do things as displays rather than actually attempting to improve their, for example, their economic position in a market. So this was this was standard operating procedure, for example, in the 1940s and 50s, and remains true to this day to some degree, but not nearly to this degree. In the 1940s and 50s, the business world and the world of higher education and the jobs associated with it were not hospitable to women. So what women did, intelligent women and women of means and high conscientiousness, were encouraged to go to schools and the best schools that they could go to in order to display conscientiousness and intelligence, not actually to get anything marketable for the economic environment. So they are there displaying those assets in order to improve their mating position. So that's what they were doing there. Okay, so a college education was a stripe on your head, indicating that the girl that is a little bit prettier than you isn't as smart and conscientious as you because she didn't go to Smith. Okay, she didn't go anywhere, but you did. And so so this is how, you know, this is how this was done. The nowadays, you could still do that, and people undoubtedly do that to some degree. And a lot of times, you know, not, I don't know, it probably serves some mating purpose, not the fancy mating purpose that it would have served in the 1950s and 60s. Most of the time, people are actually, most women today, when they pursue higher education, they are aiming at increasing their marketability. Okay, so they are also, of course, as all of us would be, also attempting to display increased intelligence and increased conscientiousness, but that's not all. So we're not just there for those displays. We're also there to try to turn this into higher dollars per hour, if we can, and also hopefully turn it into higher dollars per hour in the pursuit of some kind of a problem with which we have talent or interest. And so that's theoretically what's going on in higher education, and to some extent that is happening legitimately. Part of the reason of doing these things is to is to display. So somebody gets themselves a degree in art history from Vassar. You know what I mean? Let's face it. They're not, you know, good luck. The only job you got is a docent. So you're not going to make a nickel. So, but what it is you might meet some fat fancy guy at the cocktail party between there and MIT or whatever. That guy will actually get a job.
All right. Well, speaking of conscientiousness and going to college, our next question has to do with. It sounds like a college student who just got a roommate. Dr. Lyle, mm-hmm. I'm highly conscientious and recently got a roommate who's somewhere on the other side. He often leaves a mess. His dishes are never out of the sink. And last week, I specifically asked him to collect trash in the bin, not in the paper bags next to it, but to no avail. It takes willpower not to clean up after him at every single turn. Could you give me a few tips on how to deal with this? Or him.
Yeah, I can give you one tip specifically. Get rid of him. Okay, so eventually that will be the solution, obviously. So there's going to be some time between now and the point where you part ways with this individual. So one thing that I can help assist you in this process is what I call the mathematization of misery. So your misery, if we look at how much time it's going to take to clean up after him, probably, you know what, 10 minutes a day will probably do a halfway decent job. So 10 minutes a day, it's basically more or less an hour a week. So if you're going to be with this guy for the next year before you boot him out, he's going to steal 50 hours of your life. Okay, that's what's going to happen. And so it's not totally lost because you can be daydreaming during that time. You can also be plotting aggressive actions that you take against him. There might be some interesting activity that's going on inside your head during those 50 hours. But make no mistake, those are not an ideal use of those 50 hours. So, yeah, the solution is you just found out why it is that the six bell curves do not sound value-free. Okay. So this is where I was just speaking with a gentleman today who, you know, was deeply in, and for his career has been deeply into the Myers-Briggs, which is a totally worthless document. And the what I watched as he was struggling with my explanations to him is I was essentially watching his frustration and dissonance over the fact that he's been confused for his whole career. And in the Myers-Briggs, what do we find? We find everyone gets prizes and everybody's a good little person. Okay, so that's why it works beautifully in management seminars. You're a thinker and you're an intuitive person. Okay, you're a feeler. You're a relationship person versus you're a task person. Okay, nowhere in there is jerk, flake, worthless, stupid, you know, narcissist, and nutcase. Nope. Yet those words exist in the language, and they're there for a reason. The truth of the matter is that personality characteristics, as we describe them, are not even remotely equal and value-free. So it turns out that there's a reason why we're fixated on personality differences is because they're very, very important. And so the difference between a highly conscientious person and a flake is a lot, okay? A highly conscientious person is not going to make as many mistakes, not going to leave you open to exposure to disaster, et cetera, et cetera. They will impose some costs on you because they'll ask you, are you sure? Are you sure? Did you check? Okay. So there's some costs associated with them. All right. The person on the low side, though, is going to leave you wide open, and they're going to be very costly, which is why when we say someone is hyper conscientious, that doesn't sound like an insult. And when we say they're a flake, it does. Okay? When we say they're a sweetheart, that's not an insult. When we say they're a bastard, it is. Okay? When we say they're a nut, that is not, you know, that is an insult. When we say they're solid, like oak, solid as a rock, i.e. stable, that is not an insult, that's a compliment. When we say they're smart, that's a compliment. When we say they're not very swift, okay? Not the sharpest knife in the drawer, okay? That is not a compliment. So we see that through the Big Five, okay? We're painting the picture of things that are valuable and not valuable, and it turns out that, you know, these people with personality characteristics that are expensive, you know, they are. There's a reason why you're having the feelings you're having. Low conscientiousness, ask the guy to do some simple things, isn't going to do it. To no avail. You've done it repeatedly. You know, this is in the guy's genes. It's not changing. So you're going to be putting up with this behavior for as long as you're with him. So mathematize your misery, plot your way out, and get to a better situation as soon as it's practical. But run that. It's not, you know, it's not all... Obviously, this individual has some assets versus those liabilities. But, you know, you can tell by your own level of irritation or your own level of happiness in a relationship what the CB really looks like relative to your reasonable alternatives. And if you're writing to us, I know that you're irritated and you're a little frustrated and you're like, wow, this is not an expense that I expected to have to incur in this relationship. And so, therefore, as soon as it's reasonably practical, we're moving on.
I love it. As you can probably guess, the roommates in my life have either had to fall in line or I had to move out. So.
Oh, yeah. You got it. Sure.
Sometimes I was the messy
right.
one.
What else?
But, yeah. All right. Yeah. So our next question is about the modern notions of privacy. Dr. Ladd, do you think those notions of privacy and data security and all the rest of privacy is realistic? And how do they trace back to our evolutionary history? From how you describe the village, it doesn't seem like privacy is really a thing, with arguments even set happening in public.
Boy, we get some very interesting questions here. I would say that there was concerns about privacy and data security in the Stone Age. It's called keeping your own counsel. And people were careful to to essentially be thinking through their essentially political concerns. They leaked information strategically, and they were very careful with it. We call it plotting. And you always had to be on the lookout in the Stone Age from others looking to exploit you. And there was always somebody there's always somebody not too far away from you in your life that would be looking to exploit you. So privacy about what you're thinking and what you're up to and what it is that you want, et cetera, your interests, it's often useful to not be transparent. Now, so that same issues exist today. So this has people a little, to some degree, a little worried about, I mean, for some very obvious reasons for, you know, broad security measures with respect to the internet and so on and so forth. The obviously, people could, if they get your financial data, you know, you could be in a lot of in for a world of hurt. But beyond that, beyond those issues, your who it is, you know, things about your proclivities, your sexual issues, all kinds of things. Your, you know, who you may have been flirting with that you theoretically weren't supposed to be, you know, who you voted for, what your political leanings are. There's all kinds of things that could be problematic for you in your relationships that mean something to you that could be, you know, essentially found out, outed, or something else under the sun. So as a result, our concerns about this do go back to the Stone Age, and they walk their way right into the present. And so, no, I don't see this as a novel thing. I just look at it as the same kind of problems we've always had, except with a novel spin. And to some degree, sort of a two-edged sword. In other words, to some degree, we are more independent from other people than we ever were. In general, and so who the hell cares what anybody thinks? I'm in a free country, and if I've got skills that and that are useful for other people, and I've got some money in the bank, well, you know, who on earth is going to out me about what, and what is it going to cost me? If you're a celebrity, it could be unbelievably costly to you. But for the rank and file person, who really cares? You know what I mean? Whether you're a Presbyterian or a Methodist, and what it is that you happen to say about that, you know, last year. So the so to some degree, we are insulated from the potential magnitude of importance of outcomes that could have happened in the Stone Age. So to some degree, we are probably programmed by Stone Age level concerns to be hypersensitive about these things. I see, for example, a great deal of consternation and upset over things that are happening on Facebook. So, you know, so-and-so posted this on Facebook, and oh my God. So we got like a bunch of upset about something, and it's like, really? What tentacles do these people really have anywhere near your life with respect to any outcomes that really mean anything? And the answer is, they're tickling circuits of insecurity about where you stand in the village is what's going on. So I think we are, believe me, it disturbs me that the Ruskies somewhere in some boiler room are trying to crack the code of my bank and might lift my money out of some account. You know, that bothers me. It bothers me. I met a guy in prison that had stolen $500,000 on the internet, and he told me nobody ever figured out how he did it. So this was all a matter of, you know, stealing 67 cents from some kind of an internet transaction from a whole bunch of people for over a period of time. So the I don't care if the crooks get 67 cents, but I don't want to wake up one day and have a bunch of money stolen and then have my bank shrug their shoulders and like, well, it's sort of your fault, you know, this or that happened. So the so I think that we have legitimate concerns about some privacy and financial issues and so on, other issues today. But I think most of the anxiety that we have actually is rooted in some anxieties over deep Stone Age algorithms that are saying, I need to be very careful about what other people think and know about me. and I need to be monitoring the opinion of the village about me. And I think that social media winds up being a very disturbing, you know, essentially hypertrophy of that process that can cause an awful lot of people far more consternation and upset than is warranted. And I think it's because it's piggybacking. It's making people feel like their standing in the village is being moved around by these processes, when in fact the actual connections between individuals in their life and real world outcomes that matter are not there. Okay. Their boss isn't watching their Facebook page. Their boss doesn't care and didn't post some negative photo about what it looked like when they were having a glass of champagne over at their friend's house, you know, or they visited Tahoe. You know, none of that is happening. What's happening is instead a lot of hypersensitivity to the status losses and gains and pseudo-status losses and gains in a virtual world that is simply mimicking real life important status losses and gains of the Stone Age. So that's why I think that's what I think is happening.
Fascinating. I'm glad you brought up Facebook, but as you said, I still remember Facebook is the cigarette of the 21st century, and you've just described more reasons of it.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, an amazing innovation and invention, sort of almost incredible. It essentially tore off a blind spot in psychology. I don't know that psychologists have quite fully grasped this yet, but the notion is it's really shown the extraordinary status sensitivity of the species. We sort of knew it was there, but we didn't really know. And now we really know. If we're paying attention, now we can really see it.
Fascinating. Dr. Lyle, as always, wish you have a good night, and we'll talk to you next week.
Very good. Fantastic, Nate. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.